from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison all had something in common beyond their founding fathers' status. Beer. As Jay Brooks recounts in his new book about brewing, our current fascination with crafting beer is actually an old American tradition. George Washington liked his porter, Jefferson dabbled in home brew, but James Madison, well, forget the Federalist Papers, Madison once proposed putting beer in the cabinet. That's right, a secretary of beer. In the hour ahead, we'll jump across the centuries and get the latest on the craft brewing business today, especially the craft brewing mecca that is Northern California. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Once upon a time, the story goes, one of our earliest ancestors picked up a piece of fermenting fruit lying on the ground, took a bite. Didn't taste quite right, but there was something about it, that bitter, sweet taste. And then, bingo, little alcohol enters the bloodstream and the beer business is born. Fast forward a whole bunch of millennia to our current fascination with beer, which may even surpass that of our first fruit beer aficionado. There are now 2,500 breweries in the United States. By way of comparison, in the late 1970s, there were fewer than 90. In this hour forum, we're going to talk about the growth of craft beers in particular, and particularly here in Northern California. What's behind that, where the latest trends are taking us, what beer you should drink with Christmas dinner, and all the rest. Joining us for our conversation this hour, Nicole Ernie. She is a Oakland-based master cicerone, which is something like a beer sommelier, one of just seven master cicerones in the world, and the first female certified in that capacity. Former bartender, now working on the Cicerone Certification Program. Nicole, good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have you here. Joining us as well is Jay Brooks, writer and author about beer for the Bay Area News Group. He has a new book called California Breweries North, which contains that little story of the fermented fruit that I just referenced. Jay, good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you join us. Sean O'Sullivan joins us too. Sort of the perfect name, I think, for a brewmaster, which he is. Co-founder, brewmaster at 21st Amendment Brewery in San Francisco. Sean, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here at 10 o'clock in the morning talking about beer.
Pleasure to have all of you, all of us here. So let me just ask by way of starting, what, Jay, on what's happened? How did this happen that in the late 70s there were fewer than 80 and now there are, what, 30 times that many if I'm doing the math right?
Right.
What's behind that sort of explosion of interest?
Well, I think the biggest thing is by the time there were less than 90 breweries, most of the breweries were making beer that tasted all the same. And there's a couple different theories. People started to travel. Airline prices got a lot cheaper, so people were going abroad. They were finding beer that didn't taste like anything they had at home, and they got back home and they couldn't find it. In 1978, Jimmy Carter made homebrewing legal again, and a lot of people started homebrewing as well and realized that they could make their own flavorful beer. And so little by little, people went into their own small businesses, and the more that people did it, other people saw others doing it, and they thought, I could do that too. And, you know, there was this slope of just growing and growing numbers of craft breweries, and it all kind of snowballed.
And why so much here? At least maybe this is just parochial Bay Area thinking, but we tend to think that this is sort of, you know, from Anchor and Sierra, that this is sort of where it all took off. There were hundreds more new breweries in this past year. You wrote that there were, I don't know, like seven in the East Bay alone, I think, in one of your
new
columns.
Ones, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I'm not going to be able to dissuade you of that notion. The reason it seems like things started here is quite simply because things did start here. Anchor Brewery, when Fritz Maytag bought it in 1965, it was the only remaining brewery that was around before Prohibition. And he really turned it away from being just another regional brewery into a craft brewery. I mean, people didn't even use the term then, but he started really paying attention to the flavor. And he introduced so many new styles to the United States that hadn't been around for a very, very long time. Barley wine, porter, the idea of a seasonal Christmas beer. And then the second thing happened in Sonoma, California. Jack McAuliffe founded the New Albion Brewery, which was the first modern microbrewery insofar as he built it from scratch. He took all dairy tanks, he welded it together. He was an engineer. It was the first nano brewery. It was only a one-barrel system. And those two are seminal acts really are what kickstarted everything.
And it'd be interesting, we can come back to this, about sort of one of those has continued, one has not.
Correct.
And sort of what the risks and successes are within this business. I'm interested in sort of what drew you, Nicole, and you, Sean, to this enterprise. I mean, Sean, you're a former CNN producer, right? Mm-hmm. Former photojournalist, former law clerk.
Wore a lot of hats.
And what brought you to beer?
Well, it was interesting because I was, like you said, I was living in Los Angeles, actually, and I thought I wanted to go to law school and business school. And I started homebrewing like a lot of the people that Jay was just talking about before they got in beer. And I was kind of looking at the landscape in Southern California, and there wasn't a whole lot of craft beer happening at the time. This is like 20 years ago. And it's since changed. And I said, I want to do this. I want to go to Northern California. And I tell this story that I traded my suits for boots and I was saved by beer. I really was. It was, I go to work. I don't have to wear a suit. It's just been phenomenal.
And I should say, you're not wearing a suit.
I'm not wearing a suit, no. Right. I had a midlife crisis, essentially.
And Nicole, for you, I read an interview with you that talked about as a female bartender, you felt like you always had to sort of defend your knowledge of beer in particular. And I'm interested in sort of what drew you to that and to get this unique Master Cicerone certification, which you're the first woman to receive.
Yeah, so... these guys have a couple years on me, but I had the great experience of coming of drinking age in Northern California when there were quite a few, just a few breweries, craft breweries making great beer. And I really took it upon myself as a hobby to, like, I really want to know what all these breweries are doing. And back then you could do that because there were only, 10 or 15, and it's been fun kind of riding that wave and seeing all these breweries that have opened since I've taken that on. But yeah, as a 25-year-old bartender, I'd have a lot of people come in and just think, oh, what does this person know about beer, that did drive me to seek out some kind of formal title, and I found that with the Cicerone certification program.
So I'm interested, as a guy, I was saying before the program started, as a guy who lived in Wisconsin, sort of the old beer country of the United States for many decades. Is it, with all this great interest and fascination, do we risk getting beer being a little too? Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? I mean, is this all a good thing? Sean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's actually great. I think there's two ways to look at it. Sometimes when you go to a Belgian beer bar where it's, they've got all these sophisticated beers and different styles and flavors, you do a lot of tasting of the beer. But at the end of the day, we are drinking beer. And so if I go to a brew pub with you and we sit down and we have a pint of beer, it's about the discussion. So I think there's room in both those areas.
And where do the rest of you stand? I mean, does this you were saying, Jay, that this is, you worry about sort of the wine becoming, wine tasting versus brew,
sure,
beer drinking.
Well, there's a danger anytime you pay too much attention to anything that people bring in the snob factor. But, I think with beer, there's enough room to enjoy it. There's so much about it that is still new to a lot of people. And there's so much education that still needs to be done. And so, to sit down with a beer and drink it critically and think about it and enjoy it, to me, is still a terrific way of spending an afternoon.
So let's talk to that. I mean, you're talking to a guy who drinks Leinenkugel sometimes. So
oh dear.
Good Wisconsin beer. So how do you go about getting critical? How do you go about tasting and what is it, especially right now, that's interesting to you that people ought to go about and discern? Nicole?
So analyzing flavor is just, I like to remind people that the definition of analysis is taking something and breaking it into its parts and thinking about each of those parts separately and how they contribute to the whole. So for tasting a beer, I encourage people to start off, okay, let's talk about the obvious components of beer. How sweet is it? How bitter is it? What are the big tastes? And then when people get more advanced, I really encourage them to think about what each ingredient is contributing to the beer. Beer is really interesting in the sense that it's an engineered product. It's not so much an agricultural product like wine is. It's more like the brewer says, this is what I want this beer to taste like. Hmm. How am I going to get there?
So it's more constructed.
Yeah. It's a constructed
item. And more authored, would you say, Sean?
Yeah, I'd say that. I mean, you have a planned style that you want to attack. Let's say you want to make a porter, which is a dark, rich, chocolatey beer. And you add certain grains in order to get to that style. So you're adding chocolate malts, dark malts, a certain amount of bitterness, which is from the hops. And you're kind of going down that path to get there. Like Nicole said, winemakers more dependent upon actually the grape harvest that year.
By the way, I'll give out our number now in case you want to get in early and ask one of these brew experts your questions about craft brewing and about kinds of beers that you're interested in these days. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. So what are you working on right now, Sean? I mean, what intrigues you? What do you want to author that would take perhaps 21st Amendment in a new direction?
Excuse me. The big hot thing right now for me and actually for craft brewing is IPAs. I mean, India pale ales, which are these, you know, bitter, hoppier, stronger pale ales, a lot of hop aroma. And I there's these new hops that are coming on the scene right now, which is one of the ingredients in beer that lend the hoppy, the sort of the aroma qualities to it, you know, whether they're floral or, you know, they've got a pineapple flavor to it, and they also add the bitterness to it. So there's these new hops that are coming on the scene right now that have different flavors, and the way you orchestrate that when you're making your India Pale Ale, you have a lot of fun with it, and you can, you know, come up with different varieties of those of that style within that, you know, in a beer.
What are you enjoying about what's coming out right now, Jay Brooks, and what's some recommendations perhaps for things that people ought to go out and taste, especially in this holiday season?
Well, like Sean says, the IPAs are really the darlings of the craft beer industry right now, and there's so many somewhat new subcategories of IPAs. There's white IPAs, black IPAs, and Belgian-style IPAs. And I think that's really fun, is recombining styles together, using the new hops, as he's saying. It's like you're an artist with a palette, and you have this range of 100 different hops that you can use in combination and get just an unlimited amount of different flavors out of. Sour beers are quite interesting right now.
What does that mean, sour beer?
A sour beer it's just that. It will taste and smell sour flavors. It uses particular kinds of yeast, Brettanomyces, Lactobacillus. There are others. All beer used to be sour once upon a time before we understood yeast very well. But, you know, we got rid of that, and people are unused to those flavors. But the complexity that you get from a sour beer, you can't get almost any other way. And there's a lot more breweries now making them, and they're really terrific.
Complexity sounds pretty winey to me. You're going to be talking about oak flavored cherry whatever.
It can. I would say wine doesn't own the term complex, and we can use it just as well. And actually, I would argue that beer is more complex than wine, and therefore the term really should be ours.
Beer is absolutely more complex than wine. The breadth of flavors that beer can present is phenomenal. It kind of goes back to that idea that beer is this engineered product. You know, there's such a wide, first of all, there's four main ingredients to beer. So those are the malt, which provides the sugars for fermentation, the hops, which provide flavor and bitterness, yeast, which is a biological material. So there's a huge breadth of flavor presented just from yeast, and then water, which also has an impact on flavor, or at least how we perceive the flavors in the beer. And so that's already, you know, has a few ingredients up on other alcoholic beverages for sure. The multitude of combinations and the fact that we can also add oak chips, or we can put it in a barrel, or we can add spices or flowers or chocolate or, you know, whatever it is to a beer, means that the breadth of flavors that's presented by beer is incredibly vast, and there really truly is something for everyone.
I like to think of it as music. There's only 12 notes, but the amount of different tunes you can play with those notes is infinite. And the same is true with beer. With those limited number of ingredients, the way you can combine them and recombine them is literally infinite. So
give us some suggestions for the holiday season. You don't have to name brands, or you can if you wish. But for example, one of my responsibilities is usually that I'm supposed to figure out wine for Christmas sure. dinner. Let's say I want to go all Wisconsin, and I don't mean Wisconsin beer, but I want to go beer instead of wine. Does that make any sense at all, Sean?
Yeah,
and what would you do?
Well, for me, this time of year, I always go back to, Anchor Brewing Company, sure. Their Christmas ale, which comes out every year, and it's different every year. They add these spices, different complex flavors, a darker beer, and it just reminds me of the holiday season. It's perfect with meats and richer foods that you typically have during this time of year. I based a beer that I brew at my pub called Fireside Chat, which is sort of a reinvention of that beer because I was so taken with it. It's a little bit stronger and has a little bit more spiciness to it, but it's definitely an homage to that beer.
Yeah, the Anchor Christmas is one of my favorite beers. I always have it with my turkey dinner for Thanksgiving every year, but it's absolutely fantastic with the cranberries and the stuffing and the turkey. I think the first step is you don't have to have wine with your holiday meal. That beer is absolutely a better match for a lot of meat dishes, and many foods in general are much better to pair with beer.
Not to mention more affordable.
And more affordable. Affordable luxury is a term.
What about before and after? Is there such a thing as a before dinner beer and an after?
Absolutely, yes. And dessert beers. There are lots of dessert beers. With chocolate cake, a framboise, which is a raspberry beer, it's a match made in heaven. If you have cheese at the end of the meal, a lot of people talk about wine and cheese, but really beer is a much better match.
Yeah, people like champagne or Prosecco typically, in their holiday meals to start the meal off. I'm always like a big Saison fan, which is this, this French-Belgian style beer that has a lot of carbonation. It's very zesty. It's alive, and it just kind of pops in your mouth.
Let's start hearing from some of our listeners who want to join in our conversation this morning. Diego gets us started in Oakland. Diego, go ahead, please.
Hi. I grew up in Sacramento, and I went to Davis, so there's a lot of microbreweries around there. And recently, I moved to Oakland, and I discovered Linden Street, and it's become one of my favorite all-time beers. It's the Linden Street Black Lager. And I was just wondering, I had heard that it's Oakland's only microbrewery. Is there another one in Oakland that you guys know of?
There's a couple of brew pubs, a Pacific Coast
Brewing Company,
and there's Oakland Brewing Company is building a facility in Oakland. They're still contract brewing outside of the city right now, but they will be up and running hopefully as soon as they get their financing.
There's a few others on the way too.
Right.
The folks at Mate Vesa are opening a new small brew pub, a very tiny brew system that's going in, which should be exciting.
Yeah, Sierra Nevada just opened a tasting room in Berkeley off University called the Torpedo Room, where you can finally get a lot of the beers you could only get if you drove to Chico. And even though they're not brewing them there, it's a nice way to taste some different beers in the area.
What are some up-and-comers, places and breweries? I mean, everyone sort of knows the Sierra Nevada, Lagunillas, sure. Anchors kind of grouping.
There's a wealth of new ones, yeah. I like Freewheel in Redwood City. They are the only brewery in the country I know that's making only cask beers.
What does that mean?
Cask ales are, real ales is another name for them. They are not, they're not carbonated. They're hand-pumped the same way you'd get beer in England.
Yeah, so it's an English style ale that is actually goes through a secondary fermentation in the vessel that it's going to be served from. So, like Jay said, the carbonation tends to be a little bit lower, and instead of using carbon dioxide to push that beer through the draft system, it's actually pumped. So Americans used to joke about going to the UK and having flat warm beer. It's delicious. It's very comforting and great for froggy weather, that's for sure.
Diego, thanks for the call. Any ones that you've got your eyes on in particular, Nicole, that are you think are worth checking out right now?
First, I didn't want to leave out Ale Industries is opening a place in a brewery in Oakland too, which we're excited about in the Fruitvale District. But I'm really excited about a couple of breweries. First of all, Faction in Alameda just opened a great Roger Davis there is a fantastic brewer. He and his wife Claudia have opened this brewery their tasting room has a gorgeous view of the San Francisco Bay. They're right out on the
old airplane hangar. It's a beautiful location.
Roger's a master of hops. So like we were talking about India Pale Ales earlier, and I actually have I actually married them, so I've got a connection to that pub.
And what about – I mean, this is probably an odd question to ask you in some way from 21st Amendment, Sean, but do you – or is it not a – how competitive, I guess, is the business? Is it problematic to say to you, so what do you recommend other than your own place?
You know, it's interesting you should say that because it's all about collaboration in this field. I mean, you go to other industries. You go to – in the wine industry, there's not a lot of exchange of information. The great thing about brewers is that we may fight for, you know, that tap space or that shelf spot, your liquor store, grocery store to have our beer at. But the exchange of information that occurs with like technology, equipment, supplies, it's just free. I can call somebody up and say, hey, I need some grain, I'm out of this, or I need these hops.
Why is that? What motivates that kind of attitude? I think it's the
brotherhood and the sisterhood of brewing. I think it's a great industry. It brings people together. And what people will do, they'll bend over backwards to help you out if you're in a jam.
The majority of commercial brewers were home brewers originally. And there's a tradition in home brewing where homebrewers would get together and share their beers, and people will offer help to them. How can I make this better? Where did I go wrong? And that tradition carried over into commercial when most of these homebrewers turned pro. They were used to helping each other out, and that just carried forward. And it's somewhat unique in our field to see.
Is it a business, Jay, where there is – where the odds are decent? You know, I mean, what's the risk? Reward factor, you know, as far as how well people fare and succeed.
Well, it's hard. I mean, we opened our pub here in San Francisco in August of 2000, and it was like probably one of the worst times in the history of San Francisco to open a brewery or a restaurant, you know, which is what it is. You know, it was the end of the dot-com era. 9/11 came next year. Economic downturn. We probably almost went out of business like four or five times in that first couple of years. But you know, there was some certain things that helped us out. People like craft beer. They seek it out. Beer tourism is huge. People travel from all over the country to come out here. And to go to breweries, and they seek them out.
What do you think, Jay, in terms of can you identify kind of what the success stories versus the ones that fail?
Yeah, there are quite a few that did fail and aren't around anymore. I'm going to search for names, but it probably doesn't matter. But it seems like there have been far more successes than there have failures. A lot of the failures have had to do with you know, poor business practices. Yep. More than anything else. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of good breweries who were making nice beer that didn't make it, and it usually wasn't because they couldn't find an audience. It was because they.
I mean, one thing I'm interested in about it that maybe I read in one of your articles is that the in some ways you don't have to you can experiment a little bit with smaller sizes of your product or distribution. You don't have to worry about it if you fail and it's a small failure.
You're not in vats the size of Montana. You can afford to make a little mistake.
Yeah, I always say, you know, at our little 12-barrel brewery here in San Francisco, that you can sell your mistakes. You know, you change the name, you dry hop it, you kind of figure it out, you blend it maybe here a little here or there, and it's you know, you're not like packaging it up and trying to sell it across the country.
One of my favorite beers in the Bay Area came out of a mistake. Lagunitas has a Christmas beer called Brown Sugar, and Tony McGee, the owner, got a call in the middle of the night that they made a mistake with the recipe. And he did some quick calculations, and he told his brewers to go buy every bag of brown sugar in every grocery store, and they made brown sugar and that grew out of a mistake.
And when we come back, we'll talk more about all of these topics. We're going to talk about Kim has a question about why must beer be pretentious. Matt wants to know any Belgian styles you like. Stav wants to talk about beers on hot days. Eric about popular pilsners. Rick about. If you don't drink alcohol, is there a beer-ish drink? We'll get to all of those when we return. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. And today for Michael Krasny, our topic this hour, the craft brewing phenomenon that has so mushroomed in the last few years, particularly here in the Northern California area. Lots of comments coming in from, let me read a few, people who have identified their favorite local brews. Amir says Red Tail. Patrick says Mammoth Brewing's 395 IPA.
Oh, yeah.
Chris says, we're privileged to live near Russian River Brewery in Santa Rosa, producers of world-renowned brews. And Kelly tweets, 21st Amendment, seasonal release, fireside chat. Wow, there you go, wow. Sean. And we've got a full bank of phone lines as well. So let's get started with our calls. Matt in Berkeley joins us first. Matt, go ahead.
Hi. This is a great show. It's a topic that's really close to my heart. And I came on a little bit late. I don't know if you already recommended Linden Street Brewery in Oakland.
We did get a recommendation about that.
Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah, they're totally my favorite right now. But the thing I wanted to ask, the question I had was, I kind of came into the whole craft beer thing through the IPA door, which I think a lot of people do these days. But lately I've developed a more of a taste for like Belgian styles, especially like triples. And most of the ones that I see on the shelves are actually from Belgium. And so I was wondering if you had any recommendations for local brewers that are making good Belgian styles.
Great. Thanks, Matt. Why don't you start us out, Nicole? Because you worked at a place that specialized to some extent in that, yeah?
Right. I spent about 3 years of my life heavily focused on Belgian beer. And honestly, what I have to say is you're not going to beat those Belgian examples. I mean, they're so fantastic. You know, I think they
what
tend to be the driest.
Them?
So a triple is a fairly modern beer style. It was developed in the early mid-30s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's actually a prototype that kind of predates that by a couple of years. But it was a collaborative project, actually, with by a distiller that was a kind of a fermentation specialist as well. And it was Belgium's reaction to the popularity of pale-colored beer, which is a very modern invention. You know, beer was never that pale in color until recently, and clear. So it's a pale, very dry, very well-attenuated beer, meaning there's not a lot of sugar left in the beer. So it has a light body because of that. It tends to have a pretty fairly firm bitterness, which I think a lot of American brewers skip over when they make the style. And then as well as a plentiful amount of yeast flavor. So you get some spicy characteristics that come across like white pepper and some fruity characteristics that come across like pear. And those are all coming from the yeast. So yeast contribute a phenomenal amount to all beer, but especially those yeast forward beers.
Give me a couple of favorites.
Westmalle Triple is the benchmark example. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, the kind of basically the original. So that's a big favorite of mine. And then Ockel 8 Blonde, which is another Trappist triple. Even though they call it a blonde, it really fits neatly into, you know, what the style that we would call triple. It's another favorite.
Any other Belgian favorites, Jay?
Oh, too many to list. Just came back from two trips to Belgium in the last 30 days and drinking over there. In fact, I was at Westmalle. And the Belgians are actually, curiously enough, are a little bit nervous about American beer right now because we're making so many Belgian type of beers. But the authentic ones, it's hard to beat.
Let's go next to Kim, who joins us with a great question, I think. Kim, go ahead.
Okay. I am going to ask you a question that made my daughter's eyes roll, and I don't care.
Good for you.
Can't beer just be beer? Can't we just,
yeah.
Can something not be pretentious
about
beer?
Did you grow up in Wisconsin? Are you a kindred spirit?
I was born in Illinois and Chicago.
All right.
But I mean, honest to God, kids, can't we just make it the common person's drink?
It is.
It already is. We don't really have to work.
I want to know Kim's favorite, and then we'll get reaction. So what do you drink, Kim?
It's not about what I drink. It's about me getting together with somebody. I drink Corona, but I mean, it's me getting together with another girlfriend or some of my husband's friends. It's just sitting down, having a drink, laughing about stuff. It's not about aroma. It's not about hops. It's about friendship. And it was the common man's drink in my day.
Good for you, Kim. All right. Well, let's get reaction from our group. Thanks for raising this. Sean, start us out.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, actually, in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, beer was that. It was at the table. It was, you know, you'd sit down with your friends and you would drink it and you wouldn't break it down. I completely agree. Sometimes I think about beer and where we're going with it. And at the end of the day, it's just about sitting around at that bar and, you know, and laughing and, you know, what, and doing whatever. It's a great social, you know, lubricant.
But at the same time, our palates are fine-tuned to understand all of these flavors, especially the flavors that are presented by fermentation. Some of the enjoyable and also some of the undesirable flavors that we can taste in beer, we taste in the single-digit parts per billion. I mean, the threshold is incredibly low for the flavors that we perceive. We really are hardwired to enjoy the flavors of fermentation. And so why not delve into that and enjoy the flavors that it presents?
I guess you could make the argument that they don't have to be in opposition to each other.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can enjoy something and have a sort of refined approach to it and still take exactly the approach that Kim is taking.
Absolutely.
As well.
I mean, I think the drive is for things with more flavor. I mean, you wouldn't go for the lowest common denominator in food. You wouldn't go for the least tasty food. And I think there's a tendency to go, well, it's just food. Nobody thinks that way. But
right.
with beer, even if we're not talking about it or dissecting it, we still want it to have lots
of
flavor.
Look, I'm going to blow your minds. Every brewer has a dirty little secret. This is my dirty little secret.
You drink Miller.
Just about. I have a six-pack of Coors Light in my fridge at in cans, because sometimes you don't want water, sometimes you don't want a soda, and sometimes you don't want a big beer. You want something that's lightly carbonated and has a little bit of zeal to it.
Kim, thanks for the call. Thanks for bringing the Midwestern sensibility to this conversation. Speaking of cans,
yes.
Sean O'Sullivan, this is interesting because you pushed your brewery into taking that up. Why? Because it does seem like all of a sudden you're back in, you know, 1976 mm-hmm. or something when you drink beer out of a can.
Yeah, it was. It was actually 2005. I was out at the Great America Beer Festival in Denver, Colorado. It's the big national beer festival that we all go back to drink beer and win medals. And I went out to a little brewery in Lyons, Colorado called Oscar Blues, and I saw what they were doing. They were putting their Dale's Pale Ale in a 12-ounce can. And I went back to tell my business partner about it, and he thought it was the dumbest idea in the world. I was saying that we should get into this segment because nobody was doing it, just what you said. And the reason for that was there wasn't a lot of equipment available for small craft brewers. I mean, these machines are typically very large. You know, the large breweries had kind of a lock on that. But then the technology changed and those smaller systems were available. And the other thing that changed was that the big can suppliers lowered the minimums on purchasing cans, because when you print a can, you have to look at that can and either throw it away or use it. And so everything kind of came together. And, you know, and then also when you see the benefits of cans, it doesn't let light in, which is one of the chief destabilizers.
Hey, you think beer's better.
It's way better. It's, you know, you can take it places. You can't take glass. It doesn't break. You know, it's more portable. 70% of all cans are recycled. I can put 110 cases on a pallet of cans versus 70 for glass. So there's less energy to move that amount. So, and it's cool. You can tell a whole story on this can. Our cans are put in a nice little recyclable box, and you've got this beautiful little package that kind of presents your beer in a way for the customer.
And you've got your six-pack of Coors cans in your refrigerator at all times.
I shouldn't have brought that up. I'm going to be shamed later. I know it.
You will.
We all have our dirty little secrets.
Let's go to Juan next. Juan in Santa Rosa. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello. I just wanted to know how to start a microbrewery or where to get information.
Great question.
The Brewers Association has some resources. It's brewersassociation.org, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some literature available. They have a book, I believe, on how to start a microbrewery, which gives you a lot of the basic information you'll need.
But Sean O'Sullivan, best advice?
Yeah, best advice is to start with more money than you think you need. Absolutely. We didn't start with enough, and it really hurt. So,
all right, good luck. Good luck. What do you want to do, Juan?
I mean, I have a lot of friends that drink beer, and I just kind of have like a family kind of a brewery, and then see what happens.
All right. Good luck, Juan.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Got tons of stuff to read through here, so let me get through a couple if I can. Barbara writes, I agree with your speakers that craft beer is definitely challenging wine, particularly in approachability. But his comment that vintners don't help each other and share information is false. Famous old stories of Robert Mondavi driving his tractor to help Jack Cake Bread get started, and all of that continues still today. So stop worrying about wine. So what about that, Sean? You are preaching the brotherhood, sisterhood of beer makers being different than vintners.
I think it's because I'm so close to it. So and then I look at other industries and I see that, you know, maybe the collaborative process isn't quite as unique as what we have here.
Mark writes in, I don't want to pour bitter beer on the party, but I just read a Business Insider article regarding craft beer bubble, basically saying dozens of craft breweries have recently gone out of business. Jay Brooks.
Yeah, that's one you see a lot from the business press. I think they haven't decided what to do with us at this point, but we only represent about 6.5% of the market. Even if we were 10%, if you take a balloon and blow it up to just 10%, try and burst that bubble. See if you can burst that balloon. It's just not going to happen. I think all of they're asking the wrong questions. Are there a couple that go out of business? Even if it's a couple dozen out of 2,500, that's a pretty small attrition rate. Most of the brewers I know are double-digit growth. The idea of a bubble is really just a question for the business press. It's not real.
Jay Brooks, author of California Breweries North. You want to add something to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, when we first started distributing our beer across the country, our first year was 2008. We brewed 1,000 barrels of beer. This year, we'll do 57,000 barrels.
Wow.
That's a lot of beer in a very short period of time. It's an exciting time. I think that it's going to come down to good business practices. This is how you're going to survive: good business practices, a great beer, a quality beer. You've got to be able to make good beer. There's a lot of new beer that's coming on the scene right now that's not very good, and you got to be able to market and sell it, and it's going to just kind of come down to those basic precepts.
Science question for you, Nicole. Linda writes in, I'm a winemaker, so I know about fermentation, but brewing is more microbially meticulous than winemaking. Sour beers are getting popular. I love them, but they're notoriously difficult to deal with microbially. Explain what measures you have to take to keep that from contaminating the rest of your beers.
Right. Okay, so a lot of breweries, like Jay was talking about a little bit earlier, are making sour beer. And for the most part, we see those sour beers being produced with fermentation, with either wild yeast or also bacterial strains. And some of those are strains that are notorious for contaminating a brewery. So the brewers that make those beers have to be exceptionally careful about, you know, things like not using those same hoses. Because even no matter how much you clean and sanitize, you know, even
so it's not
a
something you can do at home? I mean, that's not a direction you'd want to do for people who are interested on the home front?
Oh, well, a lot of people that do it at home do that by mistake, don't they?
Yeah.
There's always at least one batch of homebrew in the learning curve that comes out like that. But no, it's one thing about that does make those kinds of beers difficult to make at home is batch size does kind of matter when you're looking for that kind of breadth of microbial activity, because when you have a very, very large vat, you're going to have more kind of competition of the microbes versus a smaller one, because it really becomes a microcosm and maybe you get undesirable flavors that you weren't planning on.
Here's a great question from Stav, who writes, I don't really like beer. It's good on a hot day, good with food sometimes, but on its own, no. So can your guest suggest an approach that would help me adopt a new attitude?
Well, it would be good to know what he's had experience with. I mean, whenever we hear that question, I mean, that's the first thing I want to know is what you've tried before.
So let's say someone is right. Just not generally a beer drinker, drinks wine, thinks beer is just really doesn't like the taste.
So my favorite hobby when I was bartending was to take people that insisted on ordering wine, and as long as they weren't allergic to ingredients in beer, I would just throw them samples until they said, I didn't know beer could taste like this. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes back to what I said earlier. The breadth of flavor that beer presents is phenomenal. If you like chocolate chip cookies, try a porter. You know, if you like If you like bright citrusy flavors, but you don't like a lot of bitterness, try some Belgian beers. You know, there just really is a wide breadth. One thing that I do encourage people though that do experiment with beer, they want to go out and try a lot of different beer, make sure you buy your beer from a high quality store that keeps their product cold and that you check those dates and make sure that you're buying fresh beer.
And while we're talking about experimentation, we'd be remiss if we didn't sort of add the usual cautionary notes about being careful about what you consume and how much you consume and whether is beer higher alcohol content these days? I somehow have that impression. True?
Well, it ranges. I mean, you could have lower alcohol beers to no alcohol beers to beers that, you know, are, you know, very high, 14, 16, 18% alcohol. And our IPA, our India Pale Ale, is 7% alcohol.
Craft beer tends to be maybe just a tick higher than other, you know, the mass-produced beers tend to be about 5%. I would say craft is probably in the 6 to 7 range, but they're a growing trend are session beers, which are lower alcohol beers but still full flavored.
Someone else is asking about who wants to know about whether there are any good non-alcoholic beers. Beer-ish is the phrase he uses.
The best ones I've found, maybe you can speak to this, are Austrian and German. There are some non-alcoholic wheat beers that you can find. Radeberg is a German brand that makes two different ones that are closer to the taste of beer. The Europeans use a different process to create it than American brewers do, so I haven't found those quite as flavorful. But
quick recommendation, Nicole?
For non-alcoholic beers?
Non-alcoholic?
Honestly, that's not something I pursue regularly, but like Jay was saying, like there are some Hefeweizen type non-alcoholic beers. Unfortunately, the process employed kind of brings out some papery flavors in beer, which I find so highly undesirable that I'd rather drink it with the booze in.
Lee in Santa Clara is next. Lee, go ahead, please.
Hi. I just wanted to, since we were talking about Midwestern beer experiences, I just wanted to relay something real quick. A few years back, I was at a restaurant in Milwaukee, sat down at the bar while we waited for food, and I asked the bartender, said, what do you have on tap? He said, I'll tell you what. You can order whatever you want, but the first one's on the house. He pours me a Pabst. Didn't tell me what it was. And he said, what do you think? And it's like, this is good. He says, this is a Pabst. It's like, Pabst? He's like, yeah, they're right down the street. We get this delivered every day. And so, you know, just the freshness made such a big difference and shocked me.
Lee, thank you. Two comments to respond to, Sean, perhaps. Freshness, how much does it matter? And is a fresh Pabst, even if it's Pabst, still have an advantage because it's fresh?
I think beer should be consumed fresh. There's several instances with like stronger beers we were talking about earlier, like barley wines and some imperial stouts that are higher in alcohol, where maybe you can lay them down like wine and enjoy them, you know, a few years down the line. But you always want to drink your beer as fresh as you can get it. I mean, that's when they're the most vibrant, the flavors come out more. Hops, we were talking about hops earlier. Those aroma compounds degrade very quickly unless you know consume them soon. So
beer is a perishable product. Yeah. It really is. It's not intended to be aged forever. It's very commonly abused by exposure to heat, by extensive aging. It's really important that consumers become aware of that and, you know, push all tiers in the industry to make sure that they're getting fresher beer by buying it fresh.
Some Facebook page questions. Srila asks, what happened to the old Bison Brewery in Berkeley on Telegraph? Jay Brooks, you know?
Dan closed it down. There were some problems with it, but he's still making the brand. He's actually brewing it at Mendocino Brewing in Ukiah, and they're organic certified. The whole brewery, they got organic certified just to continue making his beer there.
And Carmen writes, any recommendations on brewery tours?
Well, Anchor does a great one. If you buy my book, there's a listing for how
book plug.
Whether they do tours and for each brewery in Northern California and gives us some particulars. Otherwise, check their website or Facebook page. There's usually information about whether they do tours or not.
And Jay's book, by the way, is California Breweries North. Eno asks, is there such a thing as a session sour? I don't even know what that means.
Session beers in many cases are sour beers are very sessionable generally because they're not usually high in alcohol already. So I suppose they would be generally.
Quick explanation on session for the uninitiated like me.
Session. Go ahead.
It's a lower alcohol beer. So it's typically like I think less than 4.4% alcohol. It's a style that came out of England, and we've taken it over here in this country like we do with every style that comes over from England and any other country, and we create it and we make it our own. So,
it's not really a style.
It's more of a
it's an idea.
It's an idea. Yeah. Sort of, it's a style. It's an idea within a style.
It's low alcohol beer with that's still full flavored.
Yeah. Yeah, Nicole, go ahead.
Use that.
Oh, sorry. I'm going to read off a list here and just get your comments on them that people think are worth mentioning. Buffalo Bill's Brewery in Hayward was the first microbrewery in the United States, so just wants to get in that historical note. And a couple of current ones.
No, that's not true, actually.
No? Okay.
No, yeah.
All right. Well, sorry, Tony.
They were one of the first few, certainly. Okay.
Very early, yeah.
And some local ones to comment on. Stephen writes Triple Rock in Berkeley.
That's where I
kept my... Sacramento, Knee Deep, and Track 7. Know those, Nicole?
Yep, they're good breweries.
All good breweries, but yeah.
Triple Rock is where I cut my teeth brewing when I got in the industry when I came up from Southern California, so it's near and dear to my heart.
Triple Rock is a special place. It has quite the roster of brewers that have gone through. Yeah. It's what, a 7-barrel system?
Small little 7-barrel system. Yeah. One of the first brew pubs in the state of California. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of us who've gone through there that have gone on to open our own place.
Yeah, Jeff Kimpe is the current brewer out there. He's kicking out some awesome beers. He just won 2 awards at GABF out of this tiny, tiny brew pub brewery. Great place.
Here's someone who, you're talking about that India Pale Ales have sort of BR at the forefront, always have been, at least in my association with craft breweries too. But this person says, ales seem to be so much more popular than pilsners. Why is that?
So there's kind of two major types of beer. You have ales and you have lagers. On each side, there's a huge breadth of flavor. A lager could be anything from Coors Light to a Pilsner to a Doppelbock, which is a heavy, rich, sweet beer. Same with ales. There's everything from a very light, American cream ale all the way up to a barley wine, right? So there's a huge breadth on each side. I think Pilsners actually are a very popular beer style. But then I think a lot of folks that come over into craft beer, they're looking for that flavor. And they gravitate towards stronger tasting ales. And actually, I was going to mention earlier, there seems to be almost kind of a trend in brewing in general. In the 10 years ago, it was all about intensely flavored beers, Stone Arrogant Bastard, like really intense. Can I say that on the radio? Really intense flavored beers. Now we're seeing a bigger breadth in craft brewing. We're seeing more Belgian style beers. I actually just thought of Hen House Brewing up in Northern California, making good ones. But we also see session beers, things like that. Overall in craft, those three magic letters, IPA, those sell beer, as well as the high ABV for the uninitiated initial push into craft beer when you first start. There's a pretty wide swatch of flavors available.
Here's someone who says we should be sure to mention, and I'm probably going to blow the pronunciation here, Pliny or Pliny?
Pliny.
Pliny the Elder, the triple IPA from Russian River Brewery. And that won some big award, didn't it? A sort of best beer from
it was voting award. It wasn't a commercial competition or anything, but it's frequently rated on Rate Beer and Beer Advocate as like best beer in America.
Yeah, the Pliny the Elder is like – the Pliny the Younger is
– that's the yearly one.
That's the triple.
That's right. The triple IPA. Okay. Pliny the Younger is triple.
It's the benchmark for your Imperial IPA. I mean, Vinny Chalerzo up in Russian River is just, he's the master at that stuff.
Yep. Some others people want us to mention. Drake's Brewery in San Leandro and Dogfish Head and
Delaware.
Drake's again.
I mean, we could sit here on the radio and name breweries all day long.
We could.
But there's a few other kind of new breweries. I mentioned Faction earlier, but Cellar Maker, which just opened in San Francisco. I'm really excited about what those guys are doing over there. Another smaller brewery. It really serves the neighborhood that they're in. They're doing some great things with IPAs, and their porter is phenomenal. The Rare Barrel in Berkeley, for those of you that are interested in sour beers, they're having their grand opening this week. So Merry Christmas, Berkeley.
So let's bring it back to that in the few minutes we have remaining about this particular time of year, and either things that you'd recommend people to go out and either places to go, beers to taste, gifts to give. Sean?
Well, I mean, as far as gifts to give, I would say, there's a lot of beer books out there. I mean, we've got an author right here. It's a little softball there. There's a lot of large format bottles in the industry.
What does that mean?
It's a large, 1.5-liter bottle that are great gifts to take to parties or to give to people. So it's like your favorite beer, like we've been talking about, Anchor's Christmas Ale. That comes out in a large bottle. There's the Arrogant Bastard from Stone, same thing. And those are great gifts. They're a real presence.
Jay Brooks.
Yeah, the Magnums are a great idea. A lot of the retailers have mixed packs where they'll, you know, beers of the world, beers of the Pacific Northwest, or beers of California, whatever. And that's a good way to give to somebody who's not used to tasting, to give them a range of different things they can try. That's pretty easy. But even 22-ounce and 750 milliliter bottles make a fine gift as well. And a lot of breweries are making those.
And if you just want to sort of get started, if you're someone who tends to, you know, drink Sierra Nevada every night, but you think, you know, whatever, I'm going to try something new. You were making that associational connection earlier about if you like chocolate chip cookies, try a porter. Is that one way to think about it, to sort of think about things I like and then sort of then figure out what goes with that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I go through this when I taste wine. I don't know anything about wine, but I like to think about the things that I like. And when I talk to somebody that knows about wine, I say, hey, here's a list of things I like or things that I'm looking for today. And I usually get connected with something that I'll enjoy. And I like doing that for people with beer. And there are a number of great talents in the Bay Area that can help you find something you'd enjoy at beer stores like City Beer or at places that have, you know, certified Cicerones on staff like Hogs Apothecary in Oakland. You know, you're going to be able to find talented people that can help you find flavor that you want. And it's not pretentious. It's not going, oh, yes, I have a touch of gooseberries. It's more about connecting, with good flavors.
Yeah, talk to your beer buyer. They're a great resource. Yeah. You know, you've got Whole Foods. The beer buyers there are phenomenal. So
Turkey beer recommendation.
Something – I usually go dark. I'm really big into porter right now with turkey. That's what I was drinking for Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Turkey beer recommendation, Jay?
I like spicy beers with turkey because turkey tends to be dry and not have a lot of spice to it. So I always go for – like Anchor Christmas is my go-to for Thanksgiving, but there are plenty of other spicy beers that you could go for.
Turkey beer, Nicole?
I really enjoy fruit beer with turkey, especially the very traditional – Belgian lambics. So not the sweet stuff, not the syrupy stuff that you would have with dessert, but something like Cantillon Creek kind of replaces the cranberry. I think fruit and turkey are just a nice marriage.
And here's a website one of our listeners is recommending and a site, not just a website, to get more information about brewing at the home front. Brewlab SF, which is a brewing collective in San Francisco. They offer tastings, classes, events, brew facilities in the Mission. Their website is brewlabssf.com. That brings us to a close. It's been a fascinating hour. So thank you all so much for being part of this and getting us all smarter about getting smarter without getting too overly sophisticated. Sean O'Sullivan, co-founder, brewmaster at 21st Amendment Brewery in San Francisco. Thanks and happy holidays.
Thank you.
Joining us as well, Jay Brooks, writer, author, his book, California Breweries North. Jay, thanks so much.
Happy Christmas.
And
thanks.
Nicole Ernie, fourth Master Cicerone, first female Cicerone, Oakland-based. Nicole Ernie, thanks very much.
Cheers to beers.
Happy holidays to one and all. Try a beer for Christmas dinner. This is Forum on KQED. It's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Jim Bennett is our engineer today. And I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.